talk will be by Astrid Lambert, since she's going to review a bridge between the BE star astronomy and high energy physics. Begin with that.
Yes. So hello, I'm Astrid Lambertz. I'm a postdoc at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And so my background is high energy astrophysics. So I will give a talk about gamma ray binaries, so which are binaries composed in certain cases of a BE star and a young pulsar. And so I hope that I can convince you in this talk that gamma ray binaries can really be a bridge between the high energy astrophysics community and the stellar physics community. And I really want to thank the organizers for inviting me here, because as I was going through some literature, I was sadly realizing that, at least in the high energy astrophysics community, when they write papers about gamma ray binaries, either they don't really mention the disk, or, with a few exceptions, they treat it in a very simplistic way. And I think it is time for us, at least speaking for the high energy physics community, to include good models for the BE disk physics, and this will greatly improve our understanding of these objects. And on the other hand, the data is now precise enough that we can probably use gamma ray binaries as an additional probe for BE disk physics, and that I hope that you might be interested in understanding how these objects evolve. So I will quickly explain how high energy emission arises in binaries composed of BE stars. Then I will go to gamma ray binaries themselves, explain you why those are so puzzling objects and why we don't understand the emission. Then I will explain what we know, what we have understood so far, and hopefully in the conclusions I will be able to convince you that there's actually much more to understand and that there is still so much to do. So if you look at bright emissaries in the high-energy sky, so this is X-rays. So most of the galactic plane are actually, so the objects that we see, the bright objects, are high-mass X-ray binaries. And the majority of those systems are composed of BE stars with a neutron star, which is accreting. And the X-rays come from accretion onto the neutron star. Now if we got even higher energies, so gamma ray energy. So when I say high energy, I actually mean something that is seen by Fermi. So Fermi is a telescope that observes between 20 MeV and 300 GeV. And so the background map here is the two-year data of Fermi. And when I talk about very high energy, I mean something observed by a Cherenkov telescope, such as MAGIC, Veritas, or HESS. So in those cases, if you have a very high energy photon coming through the atmosphere, it creates a shower of secondary particles that emit a sort of bluish light that can be detected by optical telescopes. And this is how we see gamma rays at very high energy. So all the point sources I've plotted here are actually binaries. And so there's different types of them. There's actually Eta Carinae, composed of two massive stars. And in this case, the high energy probably comes from somewhere between in the collision regions of the two winds. Then all the other binaries have a compact objects. So you have classic novae, where you have accretion of the massive star onto the white dwarf up to a certain point. And once the threshold is reached, you have nuclear reactions on the surface of the white dwarf, which emit some matter into space. And when it collides with basically the circumstellar environment of the massive star, you get high energy emission. Now, then if you have, there is one BE star that has been discovered with a black hole companion, so I will not talk about it because it's the topic of the two next talks. And now there are two types of binaries with neutron stars. So if your neutron star is accreting, then you have a high mass X-ray binary. And if your neutron star is emitting a strong wind, you have a colliding wind region, a bit similar to Eta Carinae, and this is what I call the gamma ray binaries. So just a quick overview in binary evolution. If you have two massive stars, during most of their life, they will exhibit a colliding wind region. Then as one of the stars explodes as a supernova, depending of its initial mass, we can end up with a black hole. So then we are in the microquasar scenario. And if the mass is slightly lower, we will end up, most of the cases, with a fastly rotating pulsar. And so if pulsars rotate fast, they drive a wind. And then we have a colliding wind region, which is a bit similar to colliding stellar winds. And as the pulsar slows down, we have an accreting pulsar, and this is the high-mass X-ray binary phase. So this phase is much shorter than this phase. So high-mass X-ray binary is just a reminder here. We see two types of X-ray bursts. We see small bursts, which we call type 1 bursts, and the luminosity is about 10 times the quiescent luminosity. Those bursts are usually periodic. And on top of them, you have type 2 bursts, where the luminosity can increase by a factor of 10 or 100 or 1,000. Those bursts last longer and are usually not periodic. So the real understanding of these systems actually arrived with a better understanding of BE star physics, and essentially with Atsuo's work. So the understanding here is that a type 1 burst is essentially related to the companion compact object coming through the close to the BE disk and accreting some of the matter. And this happens at every periastron passage. On the other hand, the type 2 burst is an increased is an episode of increased accretion, because for some reason the pulsar is close to a warped area in the disk or some tidal arm, and this is more related to the disk physics itself. So if you actually look at the equivalent width of the H-alpha line as a function of the orbit of the companion, you see that there is a linear correlation here, and this essentially means that wide orbits have wider disks, and that there is some truncation happening by the compact object. And so, on average, those systems have smaller disks than BE stars without companion, and their disks are more dense. And here, in a careful study of VSEM 25 tau, you can see that there is a variation of the H-alpha emission, which can be correlated to the type 1 and type 2 bursts, and which suggests that the type 2 bursts are indeed related to some intrinsic variations in the disk. So I will not talk more about these systems, but I realize that we have a lot of data about these systems, and we really started understanding them once we had a good model for the BE disks. Once we started looking at tidal interactions, thinking about timescales for evolution, once we did statistics on many objects, and I think it's time for gamma-ray binaries to follow a similar path. So gamma-ray binaries, you have the interaction between a pulsar wind and a stellar wind. So you have a wind collision region. So you have a free pulsar wind and then a shocked pulsar wind. And in the same way, you have the free stellar wind and the shocked stellar wind. So at the interface between the two, you can have a lot of interesting things, and it's not necessarily a nice and smooth interface region. It can be very unstable. So in some of the cases, the pulsar can actually interact with a BE disk, and this can probably strongly affect this interaction region. So far, we have discovered 5 of those systems, and only one of them has actually a confirmed pulsar. But the emission that we see is so similar in the 4 other systems that it is very unlikely that something else than a colliding wind region is happening. So those systems have periods going from 4 days to basically 3.5 years. Most of them have a high eccentricity. And 3 out of the 5 we know so far have a BE disk, or an OE disk for this one. And in all cases, the emission has been observed as being variable. The ticked boxes mean variable emission. And by variable, I mean variable throughout the orbit and that repeated every orbit. And for some of them, there has actually been some detections for superorbital variation. So an orbit longer than the orbital period. And so these are the red boxes. So this is... I will talk about this system, although it doesn't have a BE star, because it actually makes it easier when there is no disk. So we understand this system better. And then I will talk about the 3 ones with a disk, and I will not talk about this one because it has been discovered recently. We don't have that many data, and there is no disk. So one of the smoking guns for this colliding shock region is the radio emission. So the idea in this in those systems is that the pulsar wind is basically sort of in a bubble because it's surrounded by the stellar wind. And so at the shock, you have particles that are accelerated and produce the high energy emission. And as the particles flow away from the pulsar, they cool down and they produce lower energy emission. So the lower energy emission comes from further out than the high energy emission. And this is why the radio is actually much larger than the orbit of the system. So this is not, the orbit is shown in blue here, but it's not to scale with respect of the radio emission. This is just for the illustration. So what you see is this is the massive star. The pulsar orbits around the star. And this looks like basically a shock cone. It's like a cometary tail as the comet goes around the sun. It's the same idea. So now if we look at the spectral energy distribution of those systems, we have energy all the way from the radio to the tera electron volt range. So this is 10 to the 12 electron volt. And so it peaks here in the MeV range. This is why we call them gamma ray binaries, whereas your X-ray binaries would peak around here. So this suggests that this is very different physics. And so the interesting thing here, so this is the spectral energy distribution of LS5039. In red at the inferior conjunction, so this means that the compact object is between us and the massive star. And in blue, it's the superior conjunction, so the compact object is behind the massive star. And you see that the system is different in each conjunction. And curiously, different wave bands have different behavior. So basically, it looks like the TeV gamma rays and the X-rays behave the same way, but what is seen by Fermi is different. And so this is curious. So if we look at into more details, so this is the orbit of the system. The observer would be here. The size of the massive star is actually to scale. And so if you look at the light curves in X-rays, GeV range, and then the TeV range, you see again that the light curve in X-ray and TeV are similar, and that they actually peak at the inferior conjunction when the pulsar is here, and that the lowest part is when the pulsar is here. So this suggests that the emission pattern has to do with the geometry of the system. It's basically, it depends on the position of the pulsar with respect to the observer. On the other hand, the Fermi band has a totally different behavior. And to be very honest, we don't know how to explain this so far. It might be related to actually the free pulsar wind, but it's not clear yet. What's clear is that these two emissions probably trace the same particles because they behave the same in time, while as the particles seen by Fermi probably come from a different area. So now if we go to LS6303, so again, this is to scale, although the disk might be slightly larger, actually. So if we look at the light curves, so this is radio equivalent width of H-alpha, optical, and Fermi. We see, again, some orbital modulations. And the modulation of the H-alpha can clearly be related to the presence of this disk. So in this system, so it has a 26-day orbit, but as observations were going on, people realized that there is also a super orbit, that this system varies with a super orbit of about 4.5 years. So this system has cyclic variability of 4.5 years. And so this plot represents the peak of the radio emission as a function of super orbit and orbit. So what you see essentially is that as we go further in the superorbital phase, the peak of the radio emission shifts in phase. And the green line is what the X-rays do. And the X-rays behave the same way as the radio. And they also are shifted in phase. And we don't really know yet what it is, but it's highly possible that this is related to something going on in the disk. Some precession, some intrinsic thing in the BE phenomenon. Is it related to the star itself? I don't know. I hope that you could maybe bring some light to this question. And so this also shows that if we want to compare data in different wave bands, we have to make sure that they're at the same phase, but also in the same phase with respect to the super orbit. because of this phase shift, we cannot really compare two different things. So we have to be careful when looking at this system. So now switching to PSRB-1259, which is the system where the presence of the pulsar has been confirmed, because this is a very long orbit. It's 3.5 years. And when the pulsar is very far away from the star, it is not affected at all by the star anymore. So we see the pulsed emission, and we see emission that's very similar to normal single pulsars. And so the light curves here, don't look at the Fermi one here so far. But if you look at Hess, X-rays, the radio, and the H-alpha, you see that essentially there is double peaked emission, which is consistent with the pulsar going through the disk. So here, the disk provides the simplest explanation for this increased emission. And people have tried to make models without the disk, and really it's complicated to explain the dip between the two emission peaks. And if it's related to the disk, this comes very naturally. So one thing here is that Fermi doesn't really see anything at periastron passage. There is some light detection, but not much, which again suggests that Fermi detects another type of particles than all the other wavelengths. And curiously, about 60 days after the periastron, Fermi detected a huge flare. And this is when the pulsar is about here. So it goes like this, and somewhere around here it flared. So the last periastron passage of this system was 1.5 months ago, and people were really impatient, like, is this flare going to happen again? And yes, it did. So for some reason, in this area, there is some particular orientation, something really special that makes this flare happen. And really, we don't know why. Is this still related to the massive star, or is this some strange pulsar thing? We don't know. So the last system we discovered with a BE disk, so far we really don't know what the disk, what's the orientation of the disk, so we can only guess. But we, looking at the variation of H-alpha, we know that the disk is impacted by the presence of the companion. Curiously, this system has no GEV, so Fermi does not see this system, and there have been deep searches, so this system does not emit in the Fermi band. And now if you look at so the colors here show the TEV light curves. And if you have good eyes, you can see that there is some gray points on the plot as well. This is actually the X-ray light curve. And probably you are actually the perfect audience to try to figure out which system this looks like, because the X-ray light curve is very similar to the light curve of Eta Carinae. And so this really suggests that a colliding wind scenario is at work in this system. And the fact that the TEV and the X-ray produce something similar really can give us indication on like how particles are accelerated, for example. So we're looking forward to having more data on this system. So I have shown you briefly what the observations in these systems look like. And the questions we have are essentially, okay, what are we looking at? Where does the emission come from? Why do we see those modulations? And so far, there is no theory that can explain all the modulations in all wavebands. And we really care about those systems. Well, as high-energy astrophysicists, we care about pulsar physics, because we really don't know much about pulsar winds. And gamma-ray binaries are very good probes of pulsar winds, because the interaction with the stellar wind is close to the pulsar, so we can see things close to the pulsar, and the environment is pretty well constrained. It's much better than the ISM, for example. And because of the orbital modulation, we get a lot of information. So we can also turn around this argument and say that we get a lot of information on the stellar wind conditions because the pulsar probes different environments, especially for the BE disk. And then on a more fundamental point of view, the gamma ray emission is extreme emissions, so we have basically information on things like particle acceleration and relativistic astrophysics, and this is just a wonderful topic of study. So many paths have been taken to understand these systems, all with a certain success. So I will present you what people have done so far, and then I hope we can realize that there has been some progress. We know the basics, but we don't really know the full theory yet. And it's probably time to bring all the little pieces together. So let's start with shocks. Because we have two colliding winds, we basically have a shocked structure in the middle. So a shock is basically, in a shocked region, you basically have an increased density with respect to the unshocked medium. You have a decreased velocity. You're basically supersonic before the shock and subsonic after the shock. You can reaccelerate, of course, but right after the shock, you're subsonic. And your temperature is also higher here than here. So you get different emission. And shocks are important because they're good sites for the acceleration of particles. So what happens in gamma ray binary is basically your pulsar wind is shocked, particles are accelerated here at the shock, and it's a relativistic shock, so the acceleration is very efficient, and then they can basically flow away in the shocked wind. And this is where they will basically create the high energy light, and this is how we will observe them. So we have a pulsar. Our basic understanding at the moment is that a pulsar is a very fast rotating neutron star. And so the pulsars in those systems probably have periods of the order of the millisecond. So the rotational energy that we have allows basically to pull some electrons and positrons away from the crust of the neutron star. And the magnetic field in those systems is co-rotating with the star. So at some radius from the neutron star, the co-rotation speed becomes equal to the speed of light. This is what we call the light cylinder. And at that point, the lines cannot remain closed and have to open up. And this is where those electrons and positrons can escape and form the pulsar wind. But that is our current understanding. The best example of pulsar wind nebula is the Crab Nebula. And most of the information that we have on pulsar winds come from this object. We assume that the particles are accelerated up to a Lorentz factor of 10 to the 5, 10 to the 7. I will come back later to that. Just means very, very fast. But really, we don't know how the particles are injected, what's happening close to the neutron star, what's the exact power law, we don't know. We don't know much about the magnetic field. We generally assume that the wind is anisotropic, but it's probably not the case. And we hope that gamma ray binaries can actually allow us to see what we call the free wind, I mean the unshocked wind, where we actually have the pulsar wind unaffected by the surrounding medium. So we have our pulsar wind, which creates the high energy particles. So we have a bunch of electrons and positrons being very fast, and then they will radiate basically to synchrotron and inverse Compton process. So synchrotron, basically you have your high energy particle that's turning around magnetic field lines, and this gives you high energy, this gives you non-thermal emission going from radio to essentially GeV. Then at higher energy, what can happen is that your electron basically gives away energy to a surrounding photon. So in a BE star, the surrounding photon are either from the star itself or from the disk. The disk can actually account to up to half of the inverse Compton emission in certain gamma ray binaries. So, and then you end up with a photon that's usually in the TeV range. So there is one absorption process here, which is called pair creation, where essentially your TeV photon meets again with the surrounding background photon. And if the energy is favorable, then you can create a pair of electron and positron. And this basically is why you don't have higher energy emission. So this model works pretty well. This gives sort of the shape of the spectral energy distribution. But it doesn't work all the time. And the reason is that we don't know the exact conditions for the emission. We basically don't know where does the emission come from. Is it a big region? Is it a point source? Do we have different areas? We don't really know the photon field. We know that the disk might be important, that there might be some self-Compton, so it means that the photons are reprocessed several times. And what we mostly care about is that, we basically don't know what's the density, what's the velocity, what's the magnetic field at the region where the high energy emission is coming from. So we basically wonder about the hydrodynamics of those systems. And inverse Compton is actually a highly anisotropic process. Basically, the emission you see depends on the orientation with respect to the system. And so this also has to be taken into account and can maybe account for some of the orbital variations. So these are all the problems we are facing. And so we realize that we need to understand the hydrodynamics of the system. So as I said, gamma ray binaries are sort of the same as colliding wind binaries. So we learned a lot from colliding wind binaries. And as an example, this is actually a simulation of a colliding wind binary. There's no real pulsar here. So the stars are in red. The sizes that I showed here are bigger than in the simulation. It's just to make them more obvious. So there is one star here with a strong, fast wind, another star here. So there is a shock between the two. And then at the interaction region, you basically have a mess. And the reason for this is that the wind in this from this star is much faster than the wind here. So at the interface, you have two flows with different speeds, so you get the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, so you get mess. So in a gamma ray binary, you have a pulsar wind, which is basically the speed of light, and a stellar wind, which is, I don't know, 1,000 kilometers per second, slower if it's in the BE disk. So we might end up with some mess like that. This is an open question, and it might be important for the high energy emission, actually. So now if we look at the larger scale, so this is actually a relativistic simulation. So the star is this is the star in orange, and the pulsar is the white point. And so you have a spiral structure because of the orbital motion. And this is sort of what we could see in radio. And we find the same type of instabilities. So we can use these models to use as a basis for the emission of those systems. So this is hydrodynamics, but the pulsar wind is relativistic. So we need to take it into account. So in relativistic hydrodynamics, we have basically one parameter, which is the Lorentz factor. So Lorentz factor of 1 means that your system is going slowly and that you don't need special relativity. A Lorentz factor of 100 is equivalent of 0.9999 times the speed of light, just to give you a scale here. So one thing that is caused by relativistic hydrodynamics is the reacceleration of the shocked wind. So in this plot, the star is here on the upper side, the pulsar is here. So this is the velocity as a function of distance. So the unshocked winds are in white. They're actually not simulated in this simulation. This shocked stellar wind obviously has a Lorentz factor of 1 because it's slow with respect to the speed of light. And you see that the shocked pulsar wind in this part initially is slow because it has been shocked, so it has been slowed down. And then it's reaccelerated. Now, if you are an observer and you're looking in this direction, you see the very fast flow coming towards you. And relativistic outflows actually get boosted when emission coming from a relativistic outflow is boosted when coming towards the observer. So this part will look much brighter than it is in reality. So this is maybe something that's impacting the light curves. Another thing is that this Lorentz factor is basically present in the equations of hydrodynamics. And so it will change it will change the behavior at shocks, for example. And it will change the opening angles of the shocks. So in this plot, so the star is in red, the pulsar is in black. And I represented the positions of the two shocks. There is one here. And the interface between the two shocked media as a function of the Lorentz factor. So what happens in a classical case, that's the light blue curve, both shocks are symmetric and there is no special relativity. Now, if you increase the Lorentz factor, so you make the pulsar wind more relativistic, you see that it actually becomes confined and that, on the other hand, the shock of the stellar wind goes more towards the pulsar. So we change the geometry here. So it could be that gamma ray binaries have a really confined pulsar wind. So this is important, but unfortunately, relativistic hydrodynamics are a numerical challenge. So far, it's still complicated to do multidimensional relativistic hydrodynamics. And anything above a Lorentz factor of 10 is really complicated and takes a lot of computational time. So this is something that hopefully will improve within the next 10 years, but it's still an active field of research. So we need hydrodynamics. We probably need special relativistic hydro. We also need a disk. No, really, we need one. Well, okay, you totally agree that we need a good disk, but go talk to high-energy astrophysicists. Well, the disk is, it's an increase in density with some outflow. So I've understood it. It's more complicated than this. So it can be important. Well, it will happen in PSRB 1259 as the pulsar goes through the disk. And it's probably responsible for the superorbital period that we see in LSI, which might be related to disk growth and decay and things like that. So these are two snapshots from Atsuo simulations. So these are just two different planes. So this is the simulation of PSRB 1259. So it's the density. So the star and the disk are here. And as the pulsar is coming close to the disk, it's basically blowing away part of the disk. And this is just because the wind is pushing away the disk. So this is on top of the tidal interaction that's happening. So you have two interactions here. You have one due to the wind, which is hydrodynamic, and one tidal interaction. So it would be wonderful to have those disks included in our work. There is one problem here, though, is that the time scale for the pulsar, I mean for particle acceleration and for the relativistic wind, is smaller than the time scale for stellar winds, which is much smaller than the time scale for the disk. So this means that simulations are still too expensive. We cannot orbit the whole orbit of, we cannot model the orbit of the pulsar. It's just too long. And another problem is that a disk is intrinsically 3D, especially on an inclined orbit. So this means a very long 3D simulation, and so far this is computationally impossible. So we're trying to get to a more unified model. So we've understood that if we want to model these systems, we need to bring together the non-thermal emission from the particles with the hydrodynamics. And so what we have been doing with Guillaume Dubus is basically perform a 3D relativistic hydro simulation. So far, there is no disk in our work. And then for each particle in the shocked each cell in the shocked pulsar wind, we basically trace it back to the shock. At the shock, we inject particles. Then we follow them back to the shocked pulsar wind. And we take into account the fact that they lose their energy through synchrotron and through inverse Compton emission. So then we end up with a map of basically power loss for the particle. And then we can compute the emission. And we can get spectra and maps and things like that. And we take into account Doppler boost because we have a relativistic simulation. So we can see how, if we have the boosted emission, we can see it. So just as a preliminary snapshot of our work, so this is the density field of LS5039. So this is the binary without the BE disk. So the star is on the left, the pulsar is on the right. And if you have really good eyes, you see that there are some streamlines leaving the pulsar shock. These are the streamlines that we use to follow our particles. So we have them in the forward shock, but also in the backward shock. And so this is a Lorentz factor map. And so in this simulation, we have a Lorentz factor of 7 for the free wind, just because it's too expensive to get something higher. But we know that this is not exactly realistic. And in the shocked wind, you see that we reach basically 4. So if you're an observer looking through this cone here, you see boosted emission coming towards you. And this is exactly what we realized. So we used this to compute the TEV light curve, so inverse Compton emission. So the orange is the emission we get as we see the pulsar going around its orbit, and the red is just taking into account the absorption. So if you match this with the observed light curve, we get the peaks at the right points. So we can conclude that Doppler boosted emission is a dominant factor to explain the TEV and the X-ray light curves in LS5039. So I've explained some successes of basically gamma ray binary theory, but every discovery we made basically raised more questions. So this field has really progressed a lot the last 10 years. I mean, 2004 has really confirmed that there was gamma ray emission coming from this binary. 4 years later, Fermi discovered that there is GEV emission, but curiously not really behaving the way we expected. And so now, 10 years later, we have the confirmation of variability at orbital but also superorbital periods. So we have now very high quality data. And this has allowed us to confirm basically the pulsar wind model with synchrotron and inverse Compton emission. We can explain some of the modulations. We can also link the superorbit to the BE disk. So this is great. But we're still left with many questions. We don't know the mechanism for particle acceleration. Magnetic fields, let's not even talk about it. The emitting regions, we have some ideas, but we don't really know exactly what they are. We don't really know about the impacts of tides of the pulsar wind on the BE disk. We have realized there's a superorbital variation, but what sets this period? Why does it look the way it looks? We don't know. Unfortunately, it's very hard to have the orientation and structure of the disk from observational data, so we are still guessing. And curiously, we have 5 binaries, and 3 out of the 5 have a BE disk. So this might be small number statistics and be totally irrelevant. But if this trend is confirmed, we can wonder, why do we see that many BE stars in those gamma ray binaries? So there are some questions here for high-energy astrophysicists, but most of the questions are actually related to the BE star and to the massive star community. So I made a few lists. I hope that you will remember that the pulsar samples different environments of the BE star, and that analyzing the data can give us some idea on the photon field, the density, the velocity structure, and that this is really active field of research, at least from the high energy community. So this, and it might be very useful for the massive star community. However, if we really want to exploit the data, we should better understand the particle injection models and basically understand what the pulsar does. But we should also better relate the particles to the hydrodynamics, to the structure of the wind, to the structure of the disk. And so this made me make a wish list. If I really wish that we could pursue the effort of observing at many wavelengths at the same time, because we have to take care about superorbits, and to use the experience of X-ray binaries with BE stars to incorporate the BE disk physics to improve the models of gamma ray binaries. And I also hope that computer power keeps increasing so that we can actually do those very long-term simulations. So I think we should really talk about this. Thank you. I'm glad it helped. I wasn't really sure what people would want here, and if I would have a bit afraid to talk to a wall because it's high energy for physics. But I'm really happy that if this could bring something to you. And
well, I think to me the power of all of this is the fact that it can provide yet another way to probe the disk structure and the interaction of binary systems. So I think that's a really useful thing.
So in your colliding wind models, where you're trying to match the DEB emission versus orbital phase, what kind of mass loss did you assume from the B star, or do you have any constraints on that?
So in this model, we tried to model LS5039, which is not with a BE star, so we didn't have to care about the disk, which is why we started here. So in this case, it's an O star. We have decent estimates of the mass loss rate and the velocity of the wind from some UV lines. And so I don't remember where the mass loss rate comes from, but
it comes from HST. It's just spectrum.
Okay, thanks.
From my paper.
I think I used something like a few times 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year and a velocity of 1,200 kilometers per second. And then for the pulsar, I mean, we don't really know. So I just scaled it so that the interaction region would look like this.
So then for the BE star case that you have, mm-hmm. do you have a spectral type on the BE star?
So the yes, I don't know them, but we do. Not all of them. So this one, yes, it was recently, it used to be a BE star, and it was recently decided that it was an O9. This one, we have a good estimate, but I don't know it. This one, I'm not sure, because it's rather recent, so I don't know.
Because it would be interesting to know whether these are all very early BE stars, because the stellar wind is going to be dying very quickly.
We're all very early.
We're all very early.
Okay.
I think that they're B2s.
No.
Not
09.
Yes.
No, yeah.
You see, another alternative for the quote colliding wind mm-hmm. scenario is that the mass that you're actually colliding into the pulsar wind yeah. may not be the stellar wind per se so much as the tail end of the disk that's turning into a photoevaporative outflow, which is going to be very slow.
Okay, so what would be this?
That's an absolute point. It's not the wind interaction, it's the disk.
Yeah.
Disk.
Yeah.
But that's going to be very, very slow and dramatically change the shape of the bow shock or the interacting
So if I understand what you're saying is that in the stars with the BE stars, you only have a disk interaction, essentially.
Depending on the spectral type.
Yeah. That could be very well be because in PSRB 1259, the emission disappears very closely after the periastron. So it's basically disk crossing, and that's it. So that could be.
As usual, I didn't make a comment. So Atsu and I both tried to model LS-5039 with a Michael Quasar model.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite natural that if you assume that in a Michael Quasar model, the gamma ray emission either in the TEV or in the GEV range is proportional to the accretion rate,
mm-hmm.
then it tends to peak at periastron.
Yes.
Right? But of course, the TEV gamma rays, they get absorbed by gamma-gamma interactions mm-hmm. going by the star. So the difference between the TEV and the GEV is readily explained by that difference. The fact that now you've added the X-ray observations, which are similar to the TEV observation,
mm-hmm.
it says if you have a localized X-ray source, it has to pass close to the star.
Yes.
And it's also likely to get absorbed not by the photons, not gamma-gamma interactions, but by the absorption of the material coming from the stellar wind material. So I think it would be quite possible to explain all three of those with a model that counts for absorption in the TV gamma rays and the X-rays, but the GEV gamma rays are basically directly proportional to the orbital periastron, and that's kind of what you see. And that could actually, to be honest with you, that could work for either a pulsar model or like a quasar model.
So I partially agree with what you say. The reason why I put the checkbox in parentheses here is that in LSI there has been one a very strong burst in X-rays, which is very similar.
I was talking about 5039.
Oh!
I wasn't talking about the
LSI. Sorry.
We modeled 6103, but 5039 is the one I was talking about.
Yep. So,
you mentioned it was hard to explain all three of those light curves in your talk. You mentioned it's hard to explain the X-ray, GEV, and TEV light curves at the same time.
So it's basically X-rays and TEV, we're good. It's still the GEV emission that doesn't really fit, and it doesn't fit anywhere.
It's found to be maximum at periastron. So
yeah.
The model is emitting the greatest at periastron.
But if it's related to accretion on your microquasar, how is it possible that we don't see TEV or even GEV emission in all the other high-mass X-ray binaries, which are based on accretion? All the other emission is very similar to all the other systems, so I have trouble
All right, now you're getting in the middle of the debate between the quasar and the pulsar model.
And this is getting close.
What I'm saying is that the difference is primarily that the GEV emission is dominated at periastron, and that's understandable if it's basically a density effect. If it's like the highest mass loss feeding whatever's producing the TEV. But we can talk about this more offline.
Yeah, why don't we move on to that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, I have a comment on SJ06. You mentioned that this right curve is similar to that of 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
But the mystery is that for this system, it occurs near a person, not parallel system. So it's hard to understand that phenomenon by using the colliding wind model.
So.
It is about 0.4.
I actually don't know where periastron. Periastron is phase one. Yeah, so it's here. So. Yeah. So it peaks at. Here. It's here. Yeah. Yes. Yes, I agree. It's just curious that it does the same thing. Maybe it's just happened to be, but maybe it's there is something. They're basically dominated by the massive star. So the distance is basically a few kiloparsec for all of them. So they're rather bright.
Magnitude-wise, they're pretty bright. I think 12 is the faintest so far.
12 is the faintest?
Yeah, 12 is the faintest they get.
Okay. This
is a good time to move on.